Welcome to Galaxy Brains, the weekly podcast from Galaxy Research. On top of the world, and we're back where we deserve. Banging on the track with a voice full of reverb. I'm never going back because the train has a reverse. Immerse yourself in the future. Banking system is riddled with sutures. Always at risk of suffering that loss. See me on the brink with Matt Walsh. Bitcoin going higher and you're asking me why. People want a money with an elastic supply. Don't trash it or bash it or passing you by. Just laugh and reply that you're saying goodbye. That's just the way she goes. Bask in the fact that we're slaying foes. We're running the bank like a pack of thieves. Messiah on the track, call me Lisan Al-Ghaib. As always, I'm your host, Alex Thorne, head of firm-wide research at Galaxy. Thank you for listening to Galaxy Brains. Great show for you today. We're talking with Matt Walsh, founder and general partner at Castle Island Ventures. We're going to talk with Matt about a whole bunch of stuff, his views on interesting regulatory items, where the crypto VC market is today in terms of interest and stage. And we'll talk with Matt about his early history in crypto at Fidelity. Before we get to that, we'll also talk with Bimnet Abibi from Galaxy Trading, as always, about markets and macro. Please refer to the link to the disclaimer in the podcast notes and note that none of the information in this podcast constitutes investment advice or an offer, recommendation, or solicitation by Galaxy Digital or any of its affiliates to buy or sell any securities. Another new Bitcoin all-time high. I have a sense that I'm going to be saying that a lot. Everybody stay safe out there and stay humble, and let's get right into the show. Let's go now to our friend Bimnet Abibi from Galaxy Trading. As always, Bimnet, welcome to Galaxy Brains.
Thanks for having me.
What a time it continues to be in markets, but let's jump past the new Bitcoin all-time high today, blah, 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 assuming we're in a longer Bitcoin bull market. That will happen a lot, so we're doing well. Things are going up. It's an exciting time. But let's talk about the data this week, because the big data topic was CPI.
Yep.
I guess it came in slightly hot. What happened?
It was reasonably hot. Core CPI came in at 0.4 month on month. I believe it was 0.36 unrounded. So just got the nudge higher. Key areas where, we wanted to see some slowdown in the rate of inflation, like measures like super core inflation, were still high on 4.2 handles. We didn't see goods deflation that we wanted to see. Things like car prices were a little bit more elevated. And overall, it just shows you, an economy that hasn't fully tackled inflation, and that the Fed, really, given the risk of reinflation, can't be too aggressive with rate cutting. Mm-hmm. But again, it's one of those data series you can slice and dice and find bits and pieces that look good. Like, for example, like owner's equivalent rent, which had shown a surprising pop in January due to seasonal stuff, did come off a bit, as most market participants had expected. And then if you look at the reaction in fixed income and bond markets, you've repriced higher by, let's say, 7 basis points at this point, 8 basis points. It was an important reading, and it's going to color March FOMC. And that's going to really be kind of setting the tone for markets on a go-forward basis. And mm-hmm. So it was an important data series. It showed that the economy still is dealing with high inflation, and the market is digesting it in a way that is, saying that the data is meaningful, but it's not, earth-shatteringly high number.
Right. So we're kind of, it felt like a slight creep higher, but not a jump.
Correct. But at the same time, it really depends, because, you have to contextualize it with so many different things. Like right now, I'm looking at crude oil that's moving up through $80 a barrel, West Texas Intermediate. Mm-hmm. We're looking at, if you just look at the charts of month over month inflation, it looks like it's bottomed, not like it's going lower. It looks like you've had a lot of the disinflation you're gonna have.
Yeah.
And so it becomes that much easier to surprise higher once, you get all these high numbers roll off and you just have low numbers. And then you have to contextualize it with the response function of the Fed. The Fed said they wanted to see further evidence of inflation decline, to start engaging in rate cuts.
And this isn't that.
This is not that.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's not that. It's not further evidence of decline.
Yeah, it's well off of the, 7-8% prints that we were getting, a year ago.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if you're telling me your, core PCE target's 2%, you're still a ways off.
What are we at, 3.6, as you said?
Well, that's the core CPI, yeah. But we'll see where PCE comes in.
Yeah.
But you're still, on a three handle on core PCE.
Right.
And so it's like, do you want to, start cutting ahead of your goal? And then the question is, should you even be targeting 2%?
Right.
Are you comfortable with a higher than, 2%, sort of neutral rate?
Yeah.
And so it's getting very tricky. And then the most important dynamic, which is tough for the Fed to even acknowledge properly, is this idea of, a fiscal constraint.
Right.
That's put on them because, the Treasury is issuing, tons and tons of debt, and they've got to finance their entire book of debt that's rolling off every year. And so, as you have Treasuries maturing, they have to be refinanced at, front-end interest rates that are around 5%.
Right.
Right? So imagine a 2.7 average duration or something like that, rolling off and it's got to go to 5.
It gets a lot more expensive.
And the government is just printing so much.
I forget there's a variety of ways to cut it, but if you it's a $1 trillion to the national debt every 100 days at this point or something.
Yes.
Which is just insane.
Absolutely.
I saw Balaji Srinivasan had posted a linear and exponential regression, and it's like, dude, we're at 100 trillion in 20 years.
It's insane.
It's getting very scary.
Well, my favorite thing that I saw yesterday was Elon Musk, and I think it was an Elon Musk tweet, and I think it was totally underappreciated by the market. Basically, he retweeted a guy that said, I've been getting shilled
this new scam coin.
This new scam coin.
Yeah.
And he's like, there's 27 million outstanding.
Yeah.
There's one node operator. And
pretty
there's infinite supply,
right?
And the supply is increasing at this
rate.
Absurd rate.
Yeah.
And then the butt of the joke is that that's actually the U.S. dollar.
Yeah.
And by all intents and purposes, I mean, that's exactly what's happening. And, the symptomatic of all the things we've seen in emerging market economies when you go into, crazy periods of inflation and people.
This is what happens.
Yeah. And the math, you can't argue with the math. Tell me the government's going to cut deficits, balance the budget.
Especially now, we're in an election year.
Election year.
Proposed budget from the White House. Yeah. Although I should say, by the way, there was something just for
the
news for the audience.
Budget.
Yes, they have a 30% proposed excise tax on Bitcoin miners on the electricity cost, not on their revenues. By the way, regardless of which it was, that would be prohibitive. But fear not on this or the Biden, the top line number.
Yeah.
You know that the Congress hasn't passed a budget in time since 1996. Did you know that?
Well, makes sense. And that's
almost 30 years ago.
Credit's getting downgraded, right? And
yeah,
stuff
I mean, but it really is scary.
It's so scary.
The idea that we just print forever and
people take comfort in the idea of MMT, basically, at this point. They're like, well, the Fed balance sheet will just absorb it. But there are so many moral hazards to that. People don't understand. The Treasury releases a report every year that present value calculates all future liabilities of the government. That includes Medicaid, Social Security, all of the social safety nets, defense budget stuff, et cetera. That figure is north of $100 trillion.
Yeah.
$100 trillion.
In today's dollars.
In today's dollars.
Yeah.
It's like north of 120.
Yeah.
But there's no way to pay for it.
None.
You're telling me the central bank is just going to print trillions and trillions more dollars to absorb all this stuff, and it's not going to have any real world consequences. It's absurd.
Yeah.
It the average person that is sophisticated in markets that sees this issue and thinks you can get through it. They're like, well, we'll become Japan.
Yeah.
Right. We'll just absorb that. But we've never seen this happen.
Yeah.
And
by the way, I like your point about the average smart investor who thinks it can be absorbed. There are tons of people like that. There are also a lot of very smart people who are very, very worried. Very worried. I mean, even
Larry
people
Fink.
We don't like. Larry Fink, Jamie Dimon, right?
Yeah.
Like Stan Druckenmiller, Paul Tudor Jones. They talk.
I mean,
they're among the best investors in American history.
Absolutely. And everybody's looking for a way to hedge that risk.
Yeah.
And Bitcoin is absolutely part of that narrative now. And you can't ignore it. Yeah. And that's why it's going higher.
Yep. Bimnetta Bibi, my friend from Galaxy Trading, as always, thank you for coming on Galaxy Brains.
Thank you.
Let's go now to our guest, Matt Walsh, general partner, founder of Castle Island Ventures. Matt, welcome to Galaxy Brains.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Sound like Bimnet with that.
That's Bimnet. What does he say? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me. Our audience will know Matt from being in crypto for a long time, also from the On the Brink podcast, one of my favorite podcasts in crypto. Comes out every Friday morning. And we did an episode, a joint Galaxy Brains On the Brink episode of PubKey.
That was a blast. Yeah, PubKey was awesome. And I've listened to every single one of your episodes, I think. So it's great to finally be on.
That is so nice. Even though I think you might be the only person that I've shouted out in the wrap that hadn't been on the pod already.
That was good. Yeah, I'm very curious what the wrap looks like this week.
Yeah.
I guess you haven't done it yet.
I haven't done it yet. So TBD. Matt, you founded Castle Island Ventures. You got several partners, including Nick Carter and others. You guys have grown into a pretty big fund over the years. I've been really impressed with what you guys have built and invested in. Before we get into that and what you're looking at nowadays, I would love to talk about your time at Fidelity. In fact, you've said that you were once a fly into a place consultant. This, I think, was pre-Fidelity. And that you were the guy that had to fire people at various client companies? Is that
true?
Yeah,
so before I started in crypto, I had been a management consultant. So out of college, I worked in management consulting and did a lot of work for private equity firms. And so initially, before the great financial crisis, that was a lot of looking at prospective M&A acquisitions. Mm-hmm. And so doing diligence, whether or not private equity firms should buy those companies. And then the model was we would go into those companies after they had been acquired, and we would do a lot of operational restructuring. And that turned into some headcount reduction. So I decided to go to business school after that. I didn't really like that side of the job as much.
Is that like the movie Up in the Air? Isn't that with George Clooney?
A little bit, yeah. I was traveling every week, and it was tough.
So then you went to business school, and then did you go to Fidelity out of business school?
I did, yeah. So I went to Duke for 2 years, got really into Bitcoin while I was down there. Just had some time on my hand. Fuqua School of Business.
Yep. And
then I joined Fidelity, not in a crypto capacity,
right,
because that was before crypto was really a big thing. So I initially joined in the business consulting group, like the strategy arm of Fidelity. And so that's kind of how I got my start in crypto.
Yeah, when you're a big company, you'd have your own consultants internally.
Smart model, right?
Yeah.
Consultants are expensive.
Yeah, they are. So the story goes, and certainly correct me, Abigail Johnson, the CEO, chairman, owner of Fidelity, of the Johnson family, great, great woman, a great leader. She becomes independently interested in Bitcoin. And I believe the story goes that she bought Bitcoin at South Station at a Liberty X kiosk. Shout out to those guys, OG.
Chris Yim, yeah.
Yeah. OG Bitcoin ATM company, basically. And then what? Like, became interested in it and directed some folks to start looking into it? That's the story as I've known it. But, I mean, you were there. I was there too, but not remotely near that part of the business at that point.
Yes, I don't know about that. I think that is right, that, you know, there's a lot of independent interest there. But how I came into it was...
Yeah.
We were doing this project for Peter Jubber, who was the head of strategy at the time at Fidelity, and it was a scenario planning exercise. So the idea was, let's look at disruptive technologies and let's think about what the world could look like 10 years from now.
Right.
And there was this scenario called frictionless capital markets, which did not have anything to do with blockchain. And there was another guy at Fidelity, this guy Mike Willens, who said, well, wouldn't this apply to like Bitcoin? You know, Bitcoin is a peer-to-peer system. Does anyone know anything about Bitcoin? And I was like literally just the lucky guy in the room. There was 5 or 6 consultants in the room. And I said, oh yeah, no, that's exactly right. Like that's kind of how Bitcoin works. And I was just lurking on the Bitcoin subreddit. Like,
yeah.
I was right out of business school. And I was like, that works great with this scenario. And so long story short, it became part of this scenario that we started to study. And there was 5 or 6 other scenarios at the time. But coming out of that, Peter was asked to kind of spend more time and to mobilize a team and to pair up with the FCAT folks,
yep,
you know, Sean Belka and Hadley Stern.
Yeah.
And so I got to go along for the ride with that. So it actually kind of became my full-time job for the next couple of years to just work in this R&D capacity before we started investing, which was, you know, just such a lucky career break to be in that room.
It sounds like being in the room and speaking up and knowing about the interesting, weird thing.
Yeah, you know, it was just one of these things where I got really interested in it, and it wasn't from the Bitcoin perspective. It was actually that I had done a lot of consulting work for banks, and so I knew how back office, you know, post-trade settlement worked and how to move dollars internationally. So when I saw Bitcoin, I had the total wrong impression of it. It was, okay, this actually could be a way that you could move things other than Bitcoin. And then the more time I dove into it and I was spending time in the subreddit and the Bitcoin talk forums, I started to view it a little bit more through this libertarian lens. And over time, obviously, I came to understand what I think Bitcoin is. I guess it's ever evolving, right? No one really knows what it is. But that was the initial angle. And obviously, there was a lot of detours there. We were talking about colored coins and private blockchains.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was this whole hype cycle around all sorts of different areas.
I remember when Gavin Andreessen like rage quit Bitcoin. That was a big deal at Fidelity.
Yeah,
We were following it then. I hadn't moved over to start working on it directly yet, but this was like I'm checking in with some of you guys, the early folks that were working on it, like Seth and Hadley being like, are we like concerned about this? Like, is Fidelity concerned about this? Because I know you've been looking into Bitcoin.
I remember Gavin came and spoke at Fidelity in 2014 or 15, and, you know, it was fascinating because I think at that point we all sort of had this impression that maybe he was still in contact with Satoshi. It wasn't quite clear. And so he was sort of viewed as this person who we should all kind of follow. And but right below the surface, there was this big block controversy that started to happen. You started to have a lot of these startups that were building payment infrastructure because they understood Bitcoin to be a payments technology as opposed to digital gold. So you had this kind of divergence in that ecosystem that almost split into like the private blockchain period, I would say. So a bunch of those startups that were doing Bitcoin things, you know, Bitcoin API companies like Chain, all of a sudden they were doing private blockchains on the side. And so there was this real kind of divergence there that was fascinating to watch. But the cool thing about Fidelity is we had all these people in.
Yeah.
And so we had access to.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Let's talk about that because there was the Bits and Blocks Club. I'm sure it still exists, although neither of us are there at Fidelity at the moment. But this is a great resource to me, to many. I mean, I think tons of the people that ended up working on Bitcoin and blockchain at Fidelity were employees at the company who attended those events. This is an internal education series. And were you involved in the creation of that or the curation of it?
Yeah, I take no credit for it. It was, I think Kristen Kalman was involved in that. And later Amanda played a big role
Amanda
in
Fabiano.
That. But, there were so many people that came through there.
It's
so
crazy.
We had Vitalik.
I saw Vitalik there.
And Szabo.
It was in that the first floor conference room there at the headquarters.
I had to walk him up to it. Separate meeting.
Yeah, Nick Szabo.
He told me to sit tight. He was a little bit busy building Ethereum at the time. But Nick Szabo came through. Zuko was in there.
Yeah,
Stark.
Jeff Garzik. Yep. Zuko. I was at Zuko's and Elizabeth. Jack Mahlers was there later. Chris Bernisky was there.
Sure.
I mean, truly William Mugiar at one point? Is that how it was a smatter. Maybe this was early days, though, for like companies having people. So some of these were in, 15 and 16. It's evolved a lot since then, but
it's kind of simpler times, right? I think there was not an obvious turning point yet that this was going to be an institutional asset class. It wasn't obvious to me even back then that you would have institutional grade custodians emerging. We were talking about, okay, is Bitcoin going to be a way that you could we build a payment wallet here? Like, could this be a Venmo competitor? Could we put real world securities on chain, and could this re-platform the DTCC? I spent so many hours understanding how the DTCC actually worked. I mean, it was a few years there of just trying to figure out what this was. And I'd say for me, the turning point was when ERC-20 started to happen. You know, these tokens on top of Ethereum, and people started to build things other than just the basic smart contract platform itself. Not that that's basic, but once there started to become this push beyond the monetary use case and the smart contract platform use case, I would say then all of a sudden you start to see all new companies start to stand up.
Yeah, this is sort of jiving with your original point about how you were deep into bank sort of infrastructure and thought maybe that's what Bitcoin could be used for. And obviously the app layer, as I would now call it, DeFi, all emerges from this. Let's fast forward just a little bit. So you were doing consulting, and you were sort of the strategy group's attaché to the technology innovation group on this topic. But eventually you did something else at Fidelity before Castle Island, which was sort of a a PM kind of role in this space. Tell me about that.
So there was a mentor of mine, Shemez Kanji, who's on the private investing side of Fidelity. And we had been looking at a number of startups and funds in that ecosystem. And so there was a decision made that as opposed to, investing necessarily in a bunch of these things, why don't we try to actually understand the infrastructure ourselves? why don't we start to stand up and operationalize a private fund and take a look at the token projects, take a look at the early stage equity investment projects. So we stood up a team and operationalized that. And that's where Nick comes into the fold. So Chris right. Berniski introduced me to Nick. Nick came on and joined that team. And so we're doing that under Fidelity's umbrella. And then in 2018, decided to leave and start Castle Island, really with a kind of an extension of that thesis. So I would say for a while there, we were looking at just the tokens and protocol side of the market. And as Fidelity started to build out more and more infrastructure around what became Fidelity Digital Assets, to me at least, it became pretty clear that there was a bunch of companies that had to exist that didn't exist yet. So I remember having conversations with the FDAS team around, okay, well, what is the price of Bitcoin that you're going to put on the customer statement? Like right. basic stuff, right? Like,
yeah. What was it? Not specific to them, but I mean, back then, where were firms like Fidelity getting the price? Like just one exchange?
Tradeblock had an index back then in the early days.
Acquired by CoinDesk? Is that
CoinDesk bought Tradeblock. Yeah. Tradeblock was a really, they also had an order management platform.
I remember, I used to use them as like the, just watch price live. It was solid, they had multiple exchanges. You could click through and.
Tradeblock.com/markets was the page that I spent the most time on, I think, in this industry. It was, someone should buy that URL.
But this is a good thing that investors do, by the way, right? Is talk to incumbents and understand what their needs are and what vendors they're already paying, what products they would love to have, then go find that. So asking Fidelity Digital Assets was one way that you did that early on.
Yeah, and that's kind of been my view for a while, and I guess this hasn't borne out completely, but I do have the view that every bank and every broker-dealer and every asset management firm will need to touch blockchain-based assets in some capacity. You might not want to offer Bitcoin to your customers. There's a pretty good chance you're going to have to deal with stable coins. There's a pretty good chance real-world securities will be tokenized in some form, and you're going to have to access them. And so we were looking at that and saying, well, all right, well, you're going to need compliance software. You're going to need market data. Trade execution doesn't really exist yet. We're going to need a bunch more exchanges. So there are these kind of categories that were fairly obvious if you had the longer-term view. And so we started to invest a lot more in those type of companies. Yep. And our first fund was very heavily focused on those types of infrastructure investments. Obviously, you co-invested with us in a number of them.
Yeah.
Kind of foundational infrastructure.
I call that period 2018, right? It's sort of right after the all-time high in December 2017, sort of like the golden era of crypto market infrastructure, because 2017, that run was like, you know, Bittrex, Poloniex with the troll box, it was pretty sparse on market infrastructure.
Yeah.
Coinbase was here, but again, I think they only traded like two or three tokens, there was very little out there to be used.
You can sort of look at the venture landscape, I think, through the lens of the generalists. So all the generalists come in 2015 thinking that Bitcoin is all about, you know, building a better Visa or something like that.
Yeah.
And they all get blown out. And so then they disappear for 2 years. And then they all come back for the ICO boom and they fund a bunch of vaporware. And then they all disappear. And as you point out, there was this kind of trough period where you could do early stage deals at very attractive valuations because there was not a lot of competition. There were maybe some token focused funds. Generalists were not a feature of the market back then when we got started. Kind of reminds me of now, frankly, where a lot of the generalists post FTX have been burned. Maybe they had a junior person that led a big financing in an FTX round or something. And hey, we don't do crypto anymore.
Right.
You know, they'll be back. But it's interesting how this ebbs and flows.
Yeah, absolutely, and how it dovetails with the liquid market, the token prices. I've been publishing this chart, initially at Fidelity, and still now, every quarter in my venture coverage, just showing the capital invested by VCs on a quarterly basis versus the price of Bitcoin.
Yeah,
I probably only because I've been doing the price of Bitcoin for so long. I could probably, especially more relevant for the venture capital side, I should probably do the crypto market cap. I mean, obviously it looks similar to the Bitcoin price.
Right.
But it has had various correlations and depeggings of the correlation over time. It's just an interesting thing because they tend to come in right at the top often.
I think the generalists come in towards the end of the cycle almost always.
I think Q1 2022 was the largest quarter ever, which was right after the top in 21.
And you probably had a Celsius round and a FTX round there, right? There's some big needle movers there. Telegram raised.
I think there was a OpenSea round at a $13 billion pre-money valuation.
Right. That sounds right. They'll be back.
Yeah. Okay, so it's great. I mean, I love the story. We're going to ask you more in a little bit about like your views on, you know, trends in VC today and in this market that we're heading into. I mean, I guess we're down a little bit, only at $70,700 of Bitcoin.
Do you know my block clock is broken?
I know. I tried to help you with this. They can be a little finicky to get up and running.
You know,
does it just do the lines across?
Yeah, it just does the lines across. I don't know what's going on.
I'm going to show you. I'm going to try to get mine messed up after this interview, and I'll show you how to fix it. It is a little bit annoying sometimes.
I do like looking at this over your shoulder.
It's great, right? Yeah. And when we run back through the raps or the intros or because I've been doing them from the seat for well over a year. And so, like, you just see, like, I did a Twitter video that was, like, all my raps from last year all in a row. And you just see the price, like, changing, mostly going up. Last year was a
it's been
too.
A good year.
It's getting a little stressful, by the way. Just let's talk about the markets now, because it's getting a little stressful. The last year, in retrospect, was pretty nice and leisurely, mostly a slow bleed higher. I mean, some periods of, stagnation from, like, the spring into the summer. But then you have the BlackRock filing in June and the Grayscale victory, and then pretty much just a mostly just nice trot upwards, but still well below all-time highs. Like, now it's starting to get frenetic, the feeling, you know?
I might be a little bit of a glutton for punishment, because I agree with that. I think when the bear market is there, you have more time to look at a deal. You can spend a lot more time with an entrepreneur. You don't have people from outside of crypto getting in touch with you. You know, so look, a fewer amount of LPs will reach out to me when things are really bad, right? But when times are good, everyone wants to talk to you. And
yeah, they want your view on the market.
A lot more outside noise, I would say. And so there's a little bit of that. I mean, that's something that we've talked about over the past few weeks, is just being really disciplined in this time, because this is when you can get carried away, when the market's going up and to the right.
So, like, we've been wondering, I mean, this is the first time, let me put it this way, this is the first time that Bitcoin has exceeded its prior all-time high before a Bitcoin halving, which is in just a little bit over a month, the halving, the fourth halving. And a lot of people have been speculating, what does that mean? Like, does that mean that we won't go higher after the halving? Like, historically we have. Does it mean anything? Are we speed running the cycle? What's your thought, take on this?
You know, one of the things, I guess you'd be uniquely equipped to opine on this, but I really wonder if some of the ways that we think about Bitcoin from an on-chain metrics perspective will have to change pretty materially here in the future. So does the MVRV type of ratios, does that make sense if you have just 5 global custody banks come into this market over the next 2 years, if you have a proliferation of ETF products, if you have options on those ETF products? It just seems like we're entering a new market paradigm. Now, in terms of where we are, I mean, I think it's the ETF flows are the whole story right now. Like, that's the whole ballgame. But even then, it's like, how many of these bank private wealth platforms are activated on the ETFs? How many of these independent broker dealers are activated on the platform? So I just think we're seeing a market structure change that I can't really think of a comparable in another market. This is unlike gold. There's not another asset class that you can point to and say, this is how it monetized, and this is what price discovery looked like.
Right. I even think of the gold ETFs, you know, which were a huge deal for gold, remain a big deal for gold. But there's so many things that are different. One of them is that there wasn't a $30 billion private gold fund that converted.
Right.
I was like, we already had $30 billion or whatever the number was at launch in that Grayscale GBTC fund before these were even approved.
That's right. So you have
and
that.
And we still obviously net grown net of their outflows, which is just crazy.
You know, and we're not even talking about things that people are building on top of Bitcoin.
Right.
Right.
We're just talking about owning Bitcoin and basically in an inert market access vehicle.
Right.
To your point about on-chain metrics, I mean, I think they will all they'll degrade or dampen their usefulness. Like, if you look at even MVRV is the, you know, market value to realized value. Well, if you don't move – if coins don't move on-chain, it doesn't affect the realized value at all. So, you know, if the coins are sitting in a custodian and being reassigned from one party to another without moving on-chain, which may happen, that will degrade. Certainly all the, like – addresses with a balance and HODL waves, all that stuff is going to be different. So yeah, to your point. But yeah, it looks totally different overall. We're in uncharted territory.
I think we'll need to start looking at the on-chain metrics of things that are built on top of Bitcoin eventually too, to really gauge who's using these systems. And, you know, I think the way custody is configured at these banks eventually will also impact some of these ratios, where will we have collaborative custody schemes between large banks?
Right.
And will asset managers plug into those collaborative custody schemes? Is that a safer way to hold Bitcoin versus just trusting a centralized custodian like a Coinbase with your keys?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big proponent of collaborative custody. I know you guys are an investor in Casa, among others, but I know Casa, I think, I don't see why it would be a good idea for individuals and not a good idea for institutions personally. I guess you have additional protections when you have a trust company, for example, that offers some additional protection. It doesn't protect them from losing your keys, though, right? You have MPC protocols and whatnot. Yeah,
sure. I mean, and I totally understand that this is from a regulatory perspective not possible. Because who owns that key?
But you can't have a qualified custodian with multiple key shards or whatever.
Who's the ultimate custodian, I think, is the question. Well, and how do those keys get generated?
The regulator could look into this issue and take comments and come up with a new schema for a new type of asset. Could they not?
And I think that's 10 years from now. Yeah. We'll have that conversation. But that is what investor protection will look like once we're at scale with all of these banks.
Yeah.
Do you want Bank of New York Mellon to be owning 10% of the global Bitcoin supply?
Yeah.
That seems pretty risky to me.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, any one entity, it's so the last time the first time that I went on your podcast, we talked about Dogecoin and meme coins. I have to say, of the meme coins, I am preferable to the Doge.
The
OG,
yeah.
Dog money.
I got pitched a Doge DeFi project.
No way.
Yeah.
Those exist?
Apparently, yeah.
But I want to point out, because this is another contributing factor to the questions about where we are in the cycle, the supposed cycle. That's the other thing. Not to say that it's a super cycle or that it's the capital inflows and capital storage and asset management space is so altered that it's hard for me to even say that the cycles will be cycles in the same way we even thought. But anyway, at this stage in the cycle, obviously meme coins are, frankly, in a bit of a mania. Bloomberg, I saw a host on Bloomberg said it was the season of the meme coin. It's trickling into mainstream coverage. What is that? Does that tell you anything about this space?
There's a lot going on there, right? I mean, I'm like you. I remember the cycles where it was money goes into Bitcoin, money trickles into Ethereum, and then money trickles into the longer tail. And things get really speculative on the longer tail. But some of that was no doubt a zero interest rate environment, but
true.
Some of that isn't. I mean, some of that is we're living in a world now where online sports gambling is legal in a bunch of different states.
Yeah.
And I think people are looking at these meme coins and saying, well, why would I, gamble on the Celtics game tonight? The odds are just not stacked in my favor, but I can go buy this Trump, meme coin and
right.
Off to the races. So, look, it is what it is. I mean, people are free to do what they want. There's a bunch of interesting side things, though, that are sort of second order effects of this. Is a lot of when you and I were talking about this, it was all on centralized exchanges.
Yeah.
As far as I can tell, a lot of this is happening on Solana DeFi right now. And so people are getting onboarded to these wallets. People are actually trying to figure out, okay, what does it mean to use a bridge? How do I? So I think there's some positive benefits there to just onboarding more people. Now, I think a lot of people lose money, but that's.
Yeah, totally. And frankly, in the end, certainly I'm seeing derivatives on derivatives of the coins now, which is why I was saying it feels like we're topping in meme coins. Maybe we're not at the top. I don't know. But it's not just one or two that are come out of nowhere, the next Shiba Inu or whatever. It's now 30 political named coins. And you're it's splintering and fracturing, right? But to your point about the usage, I think the on-chain usage that this is driving, which is very interesting. I think you're right. A lot of it is on Solana. And without endorsing in any way, one of the interesting ones has been Bonk for this exact reason, which is the dog coin on Solana. That was airdropped right after FTX, specifically to improve the then very beaten down Solana community, right? Because this is, obviously people know Sam Bankman-Fried had a bunch of Solana, and when FTX went down, people were like, is Solana dead? And I think across a range of metrics, it was pretty dead. There was no usage. And this airdrop actually helped engender. So it has some interesting story behind there. I'm just saying, to your point, this is the exact, that was the reason for it to begin with, was to get people using the chain again.
And they are, right? And it is kind of fascinating that the technology works as good as it does, right? Ultimately, you're talking about a lot of transactions going through, and I think that's just interesting. And I think you'll see that play out on all sorts of other chains that are going to be launching over the next couple of years. So, you know, I think the meme coins are not going away.
Yeah, to your point about the gambling sort of in America, which is a huge thing now, I'm reminded of our friend Dan Matuszewski's constant phrase. I don't know if he invented this, but the hot ball of money. That's sort of what that intra-crypto rotation trade has always felt like. It's like, it's not that like just after Bitcoin tops, a bunch of people decide they like Ethereum. It's kind of just like the trading money, the faster money is just like looking for that next, the beta, the remaining beta to suck it out of the market. I wonder what you think about this theory that I've posited and gotten. I've seen some comments on various YouTube videos in which I've said this, that people don't like this thesis apparently, but that I think that intra-crypto rotation trade will be dampened because of the Bitcoin ETFs and even further if there are ETH ETFs, because that's stickier capital. It's not sitting on Poloniex ready to rotate into alts.
So I guess the question there is how much of the registered investment advisor capital is actually wanting to play in the longer tail anyway?
Right.
I think there's a lot of crypto native money that is going to be, you know, monetized even more as the price of Bitcoin goes up, as the price of ETH goes up.
15 years of crypto native money.
Right. So there's just a lot of people that were early that'll have more capital that will see, okay, look, it seems like there's a meme coin on every new chain that launches and it seems like it monetizes. So I think there'll be plenty of money sloshing around the ecosystem. And I also think a logical next step once you have a brokerage account with access and you see the number going up, you're probably going to be looking for what's next. And so probably see a lot more people taking a look at other ecosystems that don't have ETFs, that don't have CME futures. And so they probably won't have ETFs anytime soon. So I don't know. I think this continues.
Fair. One other side point, counter a different one, but I think that's totally fair and probably right. That's why I'm cautious. I say dampened. I don't say like it's going to go away. I'm saying from some hypothetical value that it would have been the rotation trade, perhaps it's slightly less.
Right.
But the other thing is the crypto wealth effect. I mean, most people who own any crypto own some Bitcoin. So even if Bitcoin is leading a rally higher and capital literally isn't flowing from Bitcoin into other coins, well, the people that own those other coins are feeling richer. So they just raise their, you know, offers. Basically, the prices still just go up for other coins, so it can have that beta effect anyway.
So the wealth effect, that is manifest in several different categories. So I think you see the wealth effect will impact early stage investments in the ecosystem, whether that's equity investments into things that just promote the vibrancy of these ecosystems, tokens that are being built on top of these platforms. You'll see the wealth effect impact that. I think on the regulatory front, I think you'll see the wealth effect impact political donations to pro-crypto candidates. So as the number goes up, I think all of those things become more in play.
Let's talk a little bit about the venture and early stage stuff. This is still primarily, you guys are primarily an equity investment, meaning early stage equity, right?
We do about 80% on the equity side, 20% on the things that will be tokens.
Well, I guess I'm not restricting it, to be honest, between equity versus potentially tokens. What now, you know, if 18 and that period was marked by the market infrastructure companies coming out, I mean, even Galaxy was basically started at the beginning of 2018. All lending companies, the institutional custodians all launched then, not all, but many of them, right? The data companies, all that stuff came out then. What are the areas of growth that you're looking at this stage in you know, crypto history?
Unfortunately, I think Sam Bankman-Fried and the Three Arrows guys probably put us back a couple of years on some of these categories where you look at the lending markets right now, they're less mature than they were 2-3 years ago. So I think we're still in this infrastructure build out on core financial services that will continue to play out until every bank and broker dealer actually has access to this market. So that's one. Highly performant L1s is another. And so I think this will be a big year for net new launches. EVM-based chains that are faster, have some of the characteristics of Solana. So very optimistic about that. I think Bitcoin L2s are going to see a real moment here over the next year as well. So there's a number of categories that I'd say we're very focused on, mostly pre-seed, seed, Series A.
Yeah. Actually, now that you mentioned Bitcoin L2s, which I've looked at a lot as well, and I'm going back to your question about the on-chain data, this is going to maybe work as a little bit of a counterweight to the inertia of custodied or bank custodied or ETF custodied Bitcoin, but also we're already seeing it in the data. So for example, like addresses with a balance has spiked because a lot of people, like when you get an ordinal, I think you get one sat as the ordinal that may have whatever attached to it, and then 9,999 sats included as postage. So right. There's all of these like 10,000 sat UTXOs right now. And you can see this in the data, like there's in transaction volumes, in transactions of certain sizes. It does actually already impact it. But let's just talk a little bit more about Bitcoin L2s, because you were talking about, you know, initial Bitcoin stuff, even at Fidelity and banks then were like, is this, you know, the butterfly meme, is this for payments? Like, is this Visa or whatever? Like, how has, you know, obviously we've gone through this long period where the dominant Bitcoin subculture has been digital gold, monetary maximalism. Like, maybe Lightning is allowed because, I don't know, it doesn't have a token and it doesn't, and it really is decentralized for, you know, which comes with trade-offs. But we haven't seen lots of application development built on Bitcoin. Now it does appear like we're going to see more. What does that tell you? Does Bitcoin look a lot different? Does Bitcoin look a lot different in the future, you think?
I think Bitcoin looks a lot different in the sense that there will be more activity building on top of Bitcoin that ultimately has a timestamp down to the Bitcoin blockchain. But I view this as a logical progression where a lot of these early stage projects that we looked at back in the day around things like the Open Assets Protocol and colored coins and, you know, eventually Blockstack obviously came around. And there are various ways to do this and to try to tie arbitrary data down to Bitcoin. Now, what is different potentially this time is that you're going to have the ability to have the EVM on top of Bitcoin. And the EVM seems to me like it is the dominant language, right? Like this seems to me like the JavaScript of blockchain, I guess. We'll see how that comes out. Obviously, there's the Solana virtual machine will also be a factor there. But the ability to bring the EVM over, I think, will just bring more development into Bitcoin. And I think there are certain use cases where you do want those settlement assurances down to Bitcoin layer. And I think these are both financial and non-financial. I sound like a 2015 private blockchain guy, but I still think that just timestamping arbitrary data for things as basic as, okay, I'm taking a photo and I want to know the exact day that it was taken, or I have a part in the real world that I want to, you know, scan and timestamp it down to a blockchain so that a centralized company cannot manipulate a database on me. So I think there are these boomer use cases that actually will become very compelling on top of Bitcoin.
Yeah, like I don't know why DocuSign or Acrobat doesn't have like a, right, Open Timestamps was an OG that still exists, like a Bitcoin Merkle hash of hashes timestamping protocol. You can hash a document and put it on the blockchain.
I think Open Timestamps could be productized and turned into a business.
Like, why doesn't DocuSign, you know, they put the, or like Acrobat, you sign a document, they put the little, like, there's digital metadata that they're putting in there. They are digitally signing it. They even use like some types of cryptography to sign it. Why not just also hash and or have the option? I mean, that's like a no-brainer.
It seems inconceivable to me that in 10 years, every photo that we take on a phone won't be timestamped.
Or you at least have the option to turn it on.
Right. It makes a lot of sense to have those assurances.
Especially with, like, you know, even like members of royal families doctoring photos, right? Not that I'm just, that's a very recent
thing. Yeah, I don't know what's going on with that controversy.
I don't know.
Hard to keep up
with. I don't know what she is, the Princess of Wales? Is that her honorific?
Queen, I don't know.
So Kate Middleton, she apologized, actually. They did. She says they did touch it up and Photoshop it, and they're not very good at it like many people do with their photos, and people are saying. Anyway, it's an aside, but I mean, like, proving authenticity in a world that is increasingly filled with fake XYZ, I mean, images, news, anything, right? It seems like a clear...
It's not theoretical either, right? Like, there are companies, you and I know them, that are doing this in the context of insurance claim photos already. And they're not going to market and saying, hey, we're a blockchain company.
Right.
And I don't think they should. I think that it's a settlement assurance that a customer will eventually appreciate. Maybe there's not a market there yet.
Yeah.
But it's objectively a better database.
So you talked a lot about, I want to transition here a little bit. This is great. And I am, it is, by the way, still, I've been saying, like, you know, like, I'm not putting like the nail in the coffin on like private blockchains, but like, I almost like the things in the ground, and it has been like, you know, I'm laying it down there, like, but then something pops up again and we're like, wait a second, this could be the time it finally works out. It does seem like a bit of that is happening, especially with things like real world assets on chain and, you know, banks lobbying to remove SAB 121 and et cetera, right? I mean, it's I'm still holding my, I'm not holding my breath, but.
Well,
the blockchain,
I was never bullish on these private blockchains, I guess. But
yeah.
I think this idea, we used to always look at the private blockchain projects and say, you need to get cash onto a blockchain in order to make this interesting. You cannot have an off-chain settlement. And I think having a stable coin and having some sort of a token standard that can whitelist based on a KYC process makes a lot of sense. And I think you'll see more of that. And I think you can do that on almost any platform these days, which is quite different than what it used to be.
Yeah.
So, you know, this future of IBM disintermediating with Hyperledger, we're not going to live in that world. But
that has given me like flashbacks, you know, like
I mean, there was a lot of these things. And, you know, I think what we'll just see is these kind of permission, you know, side chains, subnets, whatever you want to call them.
I do like that. I had talked with our friend Christine Moy at one point, and she used to lead digital assets or whatever we call Onyx, I think is their platform at JPM. And this is how she sort of envisioned the future was like, look, it may be like a closed wall behind our company's doors or wall, but Onyx is based on a fork, you know, JPM coin or whatever. It's all based on a fork of Ethereum. So you could imagine like they have their thing here for whatever their internal ledgering needs are, but they could build a bridge and it becomes sort of an intranet to internet, like hub and spoke kind of model from the privates or to the public, the main chain.
I think that's right. And I think for some use cases, it makes more sense to have it on a public chain. For some use cases, it'll make more sense to have it on some sort of a chain that periodically timestamps arbitrary data down to a public chain.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk a little bit about regulation, Matt, because I'm a big fan of your persistent followings of particularly the Securities and Exchange Commission, but also in general the space, and your passionate analysis of developments in the regulatory complex in the United States on the brink, where you follow this stuff well. Let's start with SAB 121. This is a staff accounting bulletin, which I'll do my best, and mostly because I want to hear you talk about something more interesting than explaining to the audience what it is. There's a group that provides guidance to the accounting firms themselves on how they are supposed to do accounting for public companies, right? And this bulletin, which the SEC argued was non-binding guidance, it was not a rule, it basically said that public companies have to carry client crypto assets on their balance sheet. What was the problem with that? And it is a big problem. Congress is up in arms. They're going to maybe use the Congressional Review Act or whatever. Like, but this has been you've been a loud, outspoken critic of this accounting bulletin. What is it and why? Why is it so bad for public companies?
So the issue becomes if you are a custody bank, let's say you're a State Street, Bank of New York Mellon, you custody trillions of dollars of customer assets. If you had to record those on your own balance sheet as if you owned them, then you would need to basically extend that to your capital reserve ratios. And so let's take Bitcoin. Let's say you can charge 20 basis points on Bitcoin. You probably would have to take somewhere in the neighborhood of a 400 to 500 basis point charge from a regulatory capital perspective, but it doesn't actually make sense because you're holding the customer's assets.
Right, you can't access it in the case of like insolvency.
You're not spending it, it's not yours. And so the custody rules have evolved over hundreds of years to contemplate that. And what the SEC is basically saying that is crypto is different, and so new rules should apply. Now, putting aside that there are other types of entities that are not public banks in the United States that can actually custody these things, and so those companies that are not subject to SAB 121 are now at a tremendous advantage in this market. So, you know, why this matters is what we should be seeking to do as a country is make this a safer place for the investor. And so taking the most systemically important banks that do this for a living and custody other people's assets and not allowing them to participate in this market just strikes me as something that is not good for the United States.
Yeah, it applies to all public company or – well, the SEC had argued that it's merely like guidance. It's not a rule, but
– The GAO said it was a formal rule.
Right. The Government Accountability Office said, no, this is a rule. And I think pragmatically speaking, it is rising to a rule because – the accounting firms are basically like, what are we supposed to not go with the SEC's guidance on this? And they're the ones that do the accounting for the public companies. It does affect non-bank public companies as well. I remember right after this came out, there was like a headline in one of the stories that said like Coinbase. And by the way, this was me characterizing the headline. This didn't happen. Coinbase, if it were to go bankrupt, you, depositor at the exchange, could be an unsecured creditor.
Yeah, so Coinbase is not subject to the same bank capital provisions, so it's less of an impact there. But you're right. I mean, that story, I saw that story as well.
Right, and it doesn't allow them to have it be bankruptcy remote, basically, because now it's on their balance sheet.
So, you know, and I think Coinbase would, they say they would do the right thing in that situation. And I just think this is a bad, murky area that is very simple to fix.
Yeah.
Is kind of where I'm coming at this from, is we should be trying to accommodate the banks and the financial institutions that want to come into the space that have hired teams to actually go do this. They've built the products. I've gotten the onboarding forms from a number of these banks. And all of a sudden, the SAB 121 form.
Some of the oldest banks in American history.
Correct.
Yeah. No, it is uniquely damaging for the banks, the public banks, because they also have these bank capital requirements, which is it's also nonsensical for a securities and exchange. Maybe it isn't, but to me it seems nonsensical for the Securities and Exchange Commission to be doing a guidance, or if it arises to a rule, that so dramatically affects banks, which they otherwise don't regulate, basically.
Well, let's just call it what it is.
Banks are regulated by the FDIC, the OCC, the Fed, right? They're not primarily an SEC.
This is part of an overall choke point on the crypto industry, is really what it is. And so this is a push from the Elizabeth Warren wing of the party through Gary Gensler in order to really put the pressure on the industry. And with the view that if you can eliminate qualified custody, then you can prevent registered investment advisors from holding cryptocurrency. And so if you can just gate the capital into that mechanism, then maybe we can put a lid on this thing. And I think that's the real desire. That's what SAB 121 is. This has nothing to do with protecting investors. This has everything to do with dampening the growth of an industry.
Well, it's being challenged in the Congress. I've seen on a bipartisan basis. I'm forgetting everyone that was involved, but I know Representative Mike Flood had introduced with a Democrat.
Richie Torres was the co-sponsor.
With Richie Torres, great. And also introduced in the Senate by Senator Cynthia Lummis as well, I believe. It is just like kind of nonsensical. Like, why would it be different than any other asset that, I mean, if I literally, you can walk into a bank and open a key box or whatever, safe deposit box. And I can just like put, you know, some baseball cards in there. Well, now they're custodying that for me. And if they go bankrupt, they don't have to carry those mint, you know, Ken Griffey Jr. card on their balance sheet.
It's
crazy. I'm not going to, that's for operational security. I'm not going to talk about which scarce assets that I possess, Matt. Let's talk about another item I wanted to, which is, and you've referenced this, you said that all banks and broker dealers and what other traditional entities will touch the blockchain in some way, even if they don't offer or sell crypto assets. Let's talk about Promethean, which is, I think, the only special purpose broker-dealer, is that what it's called?
Yes.
That is, I guess, formally licensed, the only broker-dealer formally licensed by the SEC to deal in digital asset securities. I think I'm using the right language. What's the deal with this? I saw the guy testify before Congress at one point, but I haven't... followed it that closely.
I am merely an observer on this issue, but it is definitely someone should investigate this, because I really am having a hard time understanding what happened here. So Promethean gets a license to be the first special purpose broker dealer for crypto asset securities. As far as I can tell, they've never onboarded a customer. They have no revenue. I know that for a fact, because they have to file public statements. And they had a mysterious beginning, to put it lightly, around the origination of their company and selling tokens. And so you basically have this shell company without a business that gets the first license here, where there's a long list of others that I would have thought would have been logical, including Coinbase and Gemini and several others that were trying to get these ATS venues off the ground. And they're being held out as this shining example for how to comply with the law. By the way, they list Ethereum as a security.
Right. I saw that.
So that will be their first product.
Right, because they're not able, a broker dealer, and actually Commissioner Hester Peirce, who we had on the show, she and Mark Ueda wrote a great dissent just to a recent, I guess this was the Shapeshift settlement thing, but where they addressed this. They said, well, if you are a dealer, then you can only list securities. But by the way, you can't be one if you don't know if they're securities, and you can't be one if you trade anything other than securities.
Right.
So your point about ETH is what exactly here? That, like, why would they? Does that mean Promethean thinks it's a security?
Promethean is asserting that is a security, which, who knows, maybe that's the posture of Gary Gensler. We'll find out.
But they wouldn't be able to list it if it wasn't a security, according to Hester Peirce and Mark Ueda. I don't know. I haven't done the work on this. I guess broker-dealers can't trade commodities, maybe? I'm not sure. But so it's really quite explicit, at least in Prometheum's view, that it is a security. It's very strange.
Yeah, and maybe just to step back, like, what are we trying to do here? I mean, you get this clown show of a company that doesn't have a business, doesn't have any customers, that gets the first license. They're not doing anything with it. They don't have any – there's nothing going on there. There's not a single asset that they can list. And you've had probably 45 broker-dealers apply to the SEC seeking clarity on listing any number of things. So people that want to tokenize hotel buildings and people that, you know – and that's fine. That's what we should have. But we should have guidance and clarity on how to do these things. And the good news is that we have a market structure bill that has been written that makes a lot of sense, that has bipartisan support, that would give you that clarity. But in the absence of that, I just don't know why we're wasting so many taxpayer dollars doing this charade.
Yeah, it is. This was a strange saga. I mean, we'll have to see how it plays out further. You're right. I mean, there was T0 overstocks thing. I mean, people have been trying to. I remember Coinbase years ago. I don't know if they still have, but they expressly acquired a broker dealer.
They own one. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just a bizarre situation to hold out as this iconic representative. I mean, you'd think it would be someone who's been asking for it for years, right?
You know, I think there's a couple of no-brainer things that we should be thinking about as a country that should be pretty bipartisan. I think is one is just give clarity on stablecoins, and so. Why is it that we are allowing stablecoins to not be something that a regulated financial institution can feel really comfortable about their regulatory approach on? And why are we having startups go to all 50 states to get licenses if they don't want to? You know, if they want to, that's fine.
Right.
If you want to do a state path, I think that should be an option. The second thing is the SAB 121 thing, which we've talked about, that just makes no sense. I mean, the largest institutional investors in the world are going to want to custody their Bitcoin with Bank of New York Mellon and State Street. There's nothing you can do about it. And then the third thing is just market structure. And so why do we not have a market structure that accommodates broker-dealers and banks and gives them clear rules of the road on how to touch these things? If we were to do all three of those things, you'd bring more jobs to the United States than has ever been created in this industry, right? You would double the size of this industry almost overnight because everyone at all these institutions would say, okay, now we know how to do it. Let's go hire 100 people to do it.
Matt Walsh for U.S. Senate in Massachusetts.
We've got a couple good Senate candidates in Massachusetts.
I know. Hey, before we wrap, I've got to ask about a couple more quick things. What is the deal with the wildlife situation at your house? You have talked for a while about turkeys, about other types of rodents invading your – about your neighbors feeding them and causing them to come. It sounds like a tense situation, a standoff you have down there.
So, you know, during COVID, I had another kid, and we moved to the suburbs, as one does during COVID. And turns out that my next-door neighbor feeds wild turkeys. So just sits in his backyard and drinks – as far as I can tell, somewhere between 15 and 20 Bud Lights a day, and just feeds the wild turkeys. And so as a result, I have them in my yard too, which is causing a lot of problems.
They're aggressive.
Very aggressive.
And there's like weird, or I don't know if it's weird, hyper restrictive rules in Massachusetts about, like, you can't kill them. Like, they're heavily protected.
You can't. And, you know, trust me, we've explored a lot of options on that, but you really are not supposed to.
But they could kill you. They're very aggressive and mean. And there were videos, when I lived in Boston. First of all, you're in the suburbs, but these things walk around the street in Boston.
Oh, they're in South Boston everywhere. Yeah.
And they chase people.
Yeah, it's a problem. I think they were essentially extinct until like the 1970s. They came back, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
So someone reintroduced them, I think, in Abington, and they're all kind of spawned off of this guy from Abington who just
one mean
them.
Turkey or one set of mean turkeys, their descendants are terrorizing Eastern Massachusetts.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough.
And what do you think of the battle between Massachusetts and Connecticut? I hear a lot of noise from my friends in Connecticut, the Preston Burns, the Teddy Fusaros, that it's some kind of great utopia that should engulf, you know, Rhode Island and parts of Massachusetts. That seems crazy to me. I think it's pretty much just sort of like an empty forest, like filled with discarded lords from New York and Boston. But do you have a view on this?
I think they need more Dunkin' Donuts on the Merritt Parkway. I think they could make the Merritt Parkway two or three lanes bigger.
Yeah, it's a death trap.
It's really, because I think about Connecticut as really just a rest stop on your way to New York, ultimately. But I've heard other parts of it are nice, but I've only seen the Merritt.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't want to ask too much about what you guys have going on, but just in general, in the venture funding landscape, Are we back? And I'm transitioning right back to one last question I forgot to ask you. You know, VC capital invested in startups is still making a new low on a quarterly basis in Q4. I assume it will be up finally after many quarters of declines in Q1 once we close this quarter. But do you agree with that, that it's likely to be picking up? Is that the pace you're seeing? And then on the fundraising side, you talked about how the I'm really pivoting all the way back. You talked about how the generalists aren't really here yet. What about the, you know, they raise money from other sources, but what about the crypto native VC? Are you seeing interest from LPs to reallocate or asking people to get back involved and do another fund or anything like that?
Yeah, I would say, so in terms of us deploying into startups, I would say the pace of just net new company formations is picking up.
Yeah.
And so that was something that post-FTX quieted down a little bit, and it was really, I thought it was healthy because the fringe, hey, I have a token and no business model stuff started to disappear. Now a lot of stuff is back. And so yeah. I'd say volume-wise, you probably expect deals to pick up a little bit. In terms of funds going back and raising capital, there are, but there are quite a few that are raising right now. And I've kind of always wondered what the lag effect is. So if you're sitting at a foundation or an endowment, when do you notice that Bitcoin is at 70K? Is it a couple of months after Bitcoin's already been at 70K, or are you kind of leaning into it? So I think there's a little bit of a lag effect there. I'd be really surprised, outside of maybe Andreessen or Paradigm, if you see multi-billion dollar crypto funds raised anytime soon. I don't think that's the paradigm that we're in, not to use the pun there. But you know, I think inevitably people start to really perk up their interest around the price of Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, this I think you're right. And in my research, I've seen that, so 18 was a big year for fundraising. It did lag the Bitcoin price. In the 2021 cycle, it was sort of like all systems go. Like Bitcoin and VC dollars were almost perfectly correlated. But it does feel like people are sort of, LPs in particular, and I mean, I don't want to speak for everyone, but my sense is that they're still kind of waiting to be like, is this really real? It's almost like, is this an anomaly? Or wait a second, maybe the dip was an anomaly. Like the whole last 846 days since the 2021 high, we might look back and be like, that was actually the anomaly. It was accelerated by unsustainable business models and the collapse of various funds and other businesses. And maybe we would have come down from a correction, but we would not have gone that. So I think it remains to be seen. People are still, I think, in a little bit of disbelief about this rally that we've been seeing.
Well, one way to look at it is, okay, FTX happened and all these collapses and frauds happened across the industry and we're still here. And all of a sudden Larry Fink is out there going on Fox News talking about Bitcoin every 2 weeks. And all of a sudden you see stablecoins, which is just this killer use case for public blockchains where they're settling almost as much as Visa per year.
Yeah.
And so that's a clear use case. And so you used to always hear these things from, you know, you talk to LPs, well, what's the use case? Like other than Bitcoin and speculation, what's the use case? It's like, well, look at this thing. It's stable.
Stablecoins alone like disrupt entire swaths of the international banking and payments ecosystem just by themselves. If that was the only invention here, it would be game changing.
If that was the only invention in crypto, it would be the best thing for the United States because it would allow the United States to proliferate dollars to anyone in the world with a smartphone.
Yeah.
And so from a geopolitical perspective, it would be great. Now, where you're actually seeing that from a venture perspective is just a lot of startups focused on remittances and digital dollar bank accounts in Latin America. And, you know, there's all sorts of use cases there. So it'll be interesting. Obviously, stablecoins is foundational infrastructure if you ever want to get to things like gaming. And, you know, there's other places where this will be used.
Yeah. It's going to be an exciting time. I think this cycle, we really only have the Bitcoin and you know, some movement and like ETH and whatnot, and then a bunch of meme coins. I feel like the app layer, it's not really here yet. We haven't seen, you know, I'm not hearing anything about Web3 or gaming or not really. I mean, you think it's starting to poke its head out, these other historic use cases?
You know, the leading indicator for me, I remember when Metastable and Polychain launched and everyone said, oh, that's a fringe idea. That's a crypto fund. That's a put this in a little box. And now within crypto, you have dedicated funds popping up that are doing DePIN and gaming and just all sorts of specialization funds that only do privacy technologies. So
yeah.
I think that's a sign of a healthy ecosystem. I don't feel like I can look at every single category in this industry anymore. I think there are certain things you just can't do as a fund.
Like I think that's right.
We won't do blockchain-based gaming because I don't know anything about it.
Yeah, so it's impossible to be a generalist in this space really anymore. Even I think of this as a researcher. I have a team of, you know, five or six people who teach me about what's going on.
I think that's right. I think that tells you kind of where we're going as an industry. It's just more smart minds building startups.
Well, here's to that and to the rest of what is probably going to be a wild year. My friend Matt Walsh, GP, founder of Castle Island Ventures, host of The Great Show with Nick Carter, On the Brink. Thank you so much for coming on Galaxy Brains.
Thanks for having me on. Enjoyed it.
That's it for this week's episode of Galaxy Brains. Thank you to my guest Matt Walsh from Castle Island Ventures and our friend Bimnet BB from Galaxy Trading. That's it. We'll catch you next week. Everyone have a great weekend. Thanks for listening to Galaxy Brains, the weekly podcast from Galaxy Research. If you enjoy the show, please like, rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. To follow Galaxy Research, sign up for our weekly newsletter at gdr.email, read our content at galaxy.com/research, and follow us on Twitter at GLXY Research. See you next week.